Would we have colonized Mars by now if it had air? What is the ultimate fate of the stars? What's the point of talking about the density of black holes? And which movies would go into the Fraserverse? Plus, in our extended version on Patreon, will New Horizons find new targets before it runs out of power and propellant? Answering all these questions and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers, as always, wherever you are across my channel. The question pops in your brain. Just write it down. I'll gather them up and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. Oren Adrianov. Hey, Fraser, what is the ultimate destiny of stars? Will a white dwarf just burn out one day and go poof, disappearing into nothing? I'm not going to talk about supernova and they turn into black holes or they turn into neutron stars. Those have their own future destinies. Black holes evaporate, but you asked about a white dwarf. So let's go down that pathway. So a white dwarf is what you get when a star like our sun dies. It uses up all the fuel in its core. It's turning hydrogen to helium, turns helium into carbon. And then at a certain point, it can no longer maintain the pressure and temperature in its core to keep doing fusion to go up to heavier elements. And so it bloats up as a red giant, puffs out its outer layers, and then what's left is the core of the star that has now been revealed to space. And it is about half the mass of what the sun was. So if you had, you know, a star like our sun or the sun, when the sun turns into a white dwarf, it'll be about half the mass of the sun. And it is now a white dwarf. And it starts out like at the center of the sun, the temperature is 15 million Kelvin. So it is very hot. And when the sun goes through this process, bloats out its outer layers, and then it's exposed to space, it cools down to about 150,000 Kelvin. And this is the sort of what a white dwarf is. And then it's going to slowly cool down because it no longer has fusion. And as it cools down, it starts to crystallize. So, you know, it had turned all of the helium into carbon at the center of this star, and you get this blob of very hot carbon, and then slowly it cools down, it cools down, it cools down. After about a trillion years, it freezes solid and turns into a diamond, this giant space diamond. But that's not the end of the white dwarf, because you're still potentially getting particles that are forming at the center of this white dwarf, and you're getting these matter-antimatter pairs that are sort of building up at the center of the white dwarf. And after, it's a 10 to the power of 1100, so like a ludicrous amount of time. If a Google is 10 to the power of 100, after about that, you know, 10 to the power of 1100, the white dwarf detonates in this sort of puff of matter and antimatter, and it's gone. So yes, they burn out, and then a ludicrous amount of time later, they probably explode. Ian, would we have colonized Mars by now if it had air? Man, that is such a good question, because, you know, when we think about Mars today, it is the worst, right? It has very thin atmosphere made of carbon dioxide. It's pretty bad. It has one third the gravity that we experience here on Earth. It doesn't have a magnetic field to protect it from radiation. You know, there's a lot of problems with Mars. But what if it did have an atmosphere? So then you would have a place. It would probably still be cold. You know, like maybe Mars was a place like that 4 billion years ago, where it was warm enough and the atmosphere was thick enough that you had lakes and rivers and things like that. Now, it would probably still be carbon dioxide. There's no reason why it would become a breathable nitrogen-oxygen atmosphere like what we have. So then you've got a place, you've got an analogy of a place that is like that, which is Antarctica. Antarctica is cold and doesn't have a lot of plants and animals and things to live on, but it does have air, and you can breathe the air. And yet we have not colonized Antarctica. And getting to Mars and trying to set up on Mars and live there is dramatically more difficult because the distance is involved. So even if Mars was like Antarctica, I don't think we would have anything more than a research station on Mars. If it was like the most habitable place it could possibly be, it's still too awful. for us to want to colonize it for any long term. And so I love that perspective that you're like, well, okay, like what if it wasn't so bad? Would we want to colonize it then? And I don't think we would. I think we would have a research station on Mars sooner than when we eventually will. But I still don't think that we're going to have, you know, people aren't going to want to live there for very long. And all you have to look at is how many people live in Antarctica, which is just the people in the research stations. But I love that as a way to kind of set your expectations, right? What if you made Mars like Antarctica? Would we colonize it? We don't colonize Antarctica, so, and it's farther, so no. Like, I think it's really important for us to, and like, this is something you gotta like sit down and chat with your therapist about, I think, which is like, why do you want to live on Mars? Like, what is it? What are you hoping to get out of this? And I think that your opinion, your take on this is influenced by science fiction, that, you know, when they go to Mars in the studio, they're not on Mars. They're on Earth. They're breathing. It's the same gravity. They're experiencing normal amounts of radiation. They've got a crafts table they can go over and stuff their faces when they get hungry. All these things don't exist on Mars. That we have this pioneering spirit at our hearts that we want to watch episodes of Alone or Survivor and watch people struggling in difficult circumstances and feel like that is what brings out the best of humanity. But there's plenty of places on Earth that are vastly more habitable that you can go out and you're on your own and carve out a lifestyle living in tune with nature. And yet you're not doing that. So what is it about Mars? You're going to Mars because you want to help get Earth's eggs into multiple baskets? Well, there's lots of ways that we can help improve the resiliency and the future safety of humanity here on Earth. And I would argue that, in fact, we're not doing that in many cases, right? So, yeah. That is like the most brilliant question I think I've had in weeks. I love it. Thank you. Gary Dye, do you think if Venus had air, we would colonize it? So Venus is really interesting, right? Like, Venus is the same size as the Earth, roughly. It's the same mass, and it's made of the same stuff. Also, Venus has double the nitrogen that Earth has in its atmosphere. Like, Earth's atmosphere is 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen. And the atmosphere of Venus, even though it is 99% carbon dioxide, it's so thick. There's so much atmosphere that it still has twice the amount of nitrogen in its atmosphere that Earth does. And so you could take that oxygen, break the carbon dioxide, you got your oxygen, you got the nitrogen. You could, you know, if you could go and just like chip away at all those atoms, you could build an Earth atmosphere at Venus out of the raw material. The thing you're missing is the water, that Venus is bone dry. It doesn't have the hydrogen. Hydrogen was long lost. Either it got sucked into the planet or it escaped out into space because of the solar wind. And so you wouldn't get oceans and rivers and so on, but you could have a Earth-like atmosphere. But at the same time, like, Earth's atmospheric oxygen was produced by plants, by cyanobacteria. And so the cyanobacteria couldn't live on Venus. So it wouldn't last for long. Let's say that for some reason, the conditions on Venus were very much more like Earth, that you had Earth gravity, Earth mass, Earth size, roughly the same kinds of chemicals that we require, Earth density of atmosphere, that you had a temperature that was reasonable, maybe a little warmer, but not a ton warmer. You didn't have a runaway greenhouse effect. Would we colonize Venus? So it's back to that same question, which is like, are there places on Earth that are reasonable temperature? They have the same, you know, they have the gravity that you're used to in New York City or wherever you're from. And yet you don't colonize them. Right? So it's hard to go to Venus. And so I think even if Venus was perfect for life, but like didn't have plants, didn't have animals, was just a barren area, but yet you could walk around on it and breathe and not die, we would probably wouldn't do more than a research station for a very long period of time because it's still very far away, very hard to get to, very expensive to do. Cusick, why do people keep saying that black holes have immense density? The bigger the black hole, the smaller its density, for example. Black holes can be measured by two numbers, which is the mass of the black hole and the spin of the black hole. Now, you can also calculate the charge of the black hole, but let's just deal with the spin and the mass. So when you have the mass of the black hole, that gives you the size of its event horizon. And then you know the mass, you know the size of the event horizon, and then you can calculate the density. And it's a relatively easy calculation to make. And so different size black hole event horizons are going to have different densities. And the event horizon is purely just that spot where the escape velocity exceeds the speed of light. If you are able to go the speed of light and no faster, because obviously that's the speed limit of the universe, that defines it. And so you can just go and take any black hole that you want. You take its volume in, you know, I don't know, cubic meters, and you divide it by the mass, and that gives you the density. And so even though the densities can be, in some cases, lower, strangely lower than what you might be expecting, still, that is the implications of having that much mass compacted into that much of a space. Now, I always obey the algorithm, and that is because I want to make sure that we get the highest watch time here on our channel. YouTube punishes very long live streams, and so after I do the live stream every Monday, I make it unlisted. But there is a couple of very easy ways for you to get access to that unlisted live stream. The one is if you click on the notifications bell here on our channel, you'll get an email announcement for when the next live stream is going to be. That's a permanent link to where it's going to be. And so if you don't watch it live, you can always watch it after the fact. Also, every Tuesday when we publish the first of the weekly question show, I will put a link to the full unedited live stream there. So there's a couple of places. If you want access to that full live stream, it is available in a couple of places if you know where to look. And speaking of Patreon, thanks to everyone who's already subscribed and welcome to our recent newcomers, Yvonne Newton, Daniel, Team 49, Mark Baines, Simon Sturge, and Kelly Coe. Join the club at patreon.com/universetoday. Mad Monkey Oz, what movies would be in the Fraserverse? So I think a lot about this, and that is that I am exhausted by the existing way that science fiction movies are done. Like, you pretty much just get them coming out of Disney. You get Star Wars movies, you get Marvel movies, okay, you get DC movies, and you get Star Trek movies. And then you get some science fiction movies that have nothing to do with all of those. But really, what's happening with Disney is like this black hole that is vacuuming up. I know that's a bad analogy because black holes don't suck things in. But anyway, it is a whirlpool, a vortex of gobbling up movie budget. And that is because the movie companies are cowards and they want to go with established intellectual property and try to turn those things into movies that have the best chance of returning their money. And they're not willing to take risks on really interesting and exciting story ideas. But there are so many incredible stories that have been told in science fiction books that are just waiting. Like Dune is the tip of the Sandberg here. The Expanse is a good example of a really well-told science fiction series that was just ready and ripe to be turned into a television show. And they did a phenomenal job of turning it. And now The Expanse is one of the best television shows, best science fiction shows ever made. And so I'm sure people who are watching this, you can think of the kinds of movies that could be made from some of the best science fiction stories that have ever been told for decades, all the way back to the 1960s. A lot of those stories still hold up. You know, Foundation is a good example, but you could turn these into television shows. And so if I could, some of you are going to cancel me today and you're never going to come back. And I understand that. And I'm sorry this is how I feel. But I would not make any more superhero movies except for Invincible, which is in a movie. It's a television show. But anyway, I would not make any more Star Wars movies. I would not make any more Star Trek shows. And like, I like Strange New Worlds. It's fine. It's a good show. But anyway, I would take that budget, the billions and billions of dollars, and I would invest it in turning wonderful science fiction books into incredible movies across tons of different genres. Just, I'm so sick of superheroes. So sick. And I'm sick of Star Wars, except for Andor. Andor can stay, but the rest of it can get lost and is and be replaced with money spent on turning incredible, innovative, creative science fiction stories into other media, television and movies. That's what I want. And I know I'm not going to get that, but yeah, there's so many good books, so many good stories that have been told and they're just sitting there. You know, we got The Martian. Like, The Martian is the perfect, like, didn't you love The Martian? Where did that come from? It came from Andy Weir, who was a computer programmer, and he wrote this book and he released it online. And then later on, he turned it into a book and then it got picked up as a movie and it was phenomenal. And another Andy Weir movie is coming out with Project Hail Mary. And hopefully that's still going to be good. But even that, like, you're dipping into the well twice, the Andy Weir well twice. And I'm not a giant fan of that. I'd rather they spread the money around and they go and talk to different authors. When are we going to see an Ursula K. Le Guin story? When are we going to see some more Isaac Asimov stuff? When are we going to see some more Ray Bradbury stuff? When are we going to see some Paul Anderson, Larry Niven, Jerry Pournelle? God, there's so many great authors for decades and decades and decades. And now you're getting this fragmentation of media where people don't share, you know, you got Dune. Okay, fine. Dune, they did a great job. They made a great, you know, version of Dune. And then you got the Prophecy of Doom. Well, now it's starting to turn into a new, like, you're going to have, you know, like Dune Emperor. You're going to have the Children of Dune. You're going to have Lil Dune. Right? You're going to have animated Dune, rogue Dune soldiers. Anyway, so that's what I want. All Heinlein. Yes. Ben Bova. Vervinge. You mean added a Vervinge? That'd be like, yeah, that would be so great. Yes, please. Pura Vida Hoser. Do neutrinos move faster than light as we know it? No, neutrinos do not move faster than the speed of light. They move a little bit slower than the speed of light. And neutrinos, these are particles that are produced in nuclear reactions. They're streaming out of the sun. You have countless neutrinos passing through your body at all times. And that's because they don't interact with regular matter. You know, it's always been said, you know, a neutrino can pass through a light year of lead unaffected. And so, yeah, you've got neutrinos streaming through you right now. They go right through the Earth and so on. But they do this slower than the speed of light. And there was a controversial discovery about a decade ago where some researchers thought that they had detected neutrinos moving faster than the speed of light. And they had sort of set up an emitter in one location. They'd set up a detector in another location and they'd measured how long it took for the neutrinos to go from the source to the detector. And they calculated that it was going faster than the speed of light. And this was a huge announcement and discovery and it broke the laws of physics as we understood it. And it turns out there was a loose cable in their system that was measuring the travel time. And once they, I don't know, like screwed it back in, then the neutrino travel time behaved properly, which is that it's a little bit slower than the speed of light, but not a lot. You know, we always talk about this idea of supernova going off, that the first thing that we see after a supernova goes off are the neutrinos. And it's not because the neutrinos are going faster than the speed of light. It's that the neutrinos can get out of the star faster than the radiation does, because the radiation piles up inside. It's stopped by all of the particles of the star, while the neutrinos, as I said, they pass right through matter. And so they get a head start on the light escaping from the supernova. And then we see the neutrino flash, and then within a couple of hours, like 3 hours, then the light shows up. The reality is the light was traveling faster this whole time and it had to catch up to the neutrino burst. That's for like Betelgeuse. You know, if the distances are farther, then the gap grows. But no, neutrinos do not move faster than the speed of light. We've got a much longer version of this show with one additional question over on Patreon. So if you want to watch it with no ads, totally free, click the card or the link in the show notes. All right, those are all the questions that we had this episode. Thank you, everyone, who asked your questions here in the YouTube comments, as well as everybody who asked your questions during the two-hour live stream, which we record every Monday at 5 p.m. somewhere on Earth. Now, I'm going to chat about AI slop, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Barely Griffing, David Gilton, David Matz, Dustin Cable, Greg Feely, Hudson Ward, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Michael Purcell, Paul Robach, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fondermelli, Thomas L. Skadron, and Vlad Chiblin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So we are a couple of years now into the AI slop epoch on YouTube, where a large number of the videos here on the channel are just low quality AI slop. The scripts are written by AI, the graphics are produced by AI, the thumbnails are designed to titillate and freak people out, and the channels that are doing this are really succeeding. That I see a lot of videos that I know are complete nonsense. No, astronomers did not find a planet at the beginning of the universe, or proof of life, or city lights on another star. And astronomers are not weeping into their hands, admitting that they were wrong. This is all just garbage. And the problem is that YouTube has had years now to deal with this problem, and they haven't dealt with it. In fact, they double down on it. Now, you creators out there that are watching this, those of you who actually have go into the YouTube studio and you go to the section where it shows you what are the kinds of inspirational videos that you should take a look at, mine are all AI slop. So, like, not only is YouTube allowing this stuff to be on the platform, they are encouraging me to use that as inspiration, like get sloppy, as well as it recommending various AI tools to create videos. Like, obviously, this is bad for education. This is bad for the people who are watching these videos. It is going to be long-term bad for YouTube, and it's bad for creators. And either YouTube is unwilling or YouTube is unable to deal with this problem. And I want to know what you do. How do you deal with the problem? Do you see these videos and just filter them off in your brain? Do you report them every time you see them to try and get these channels taken down? Does anybody know of anyone who is having any kind of success in combating this? Because I sure don't. I know Kyle Hill has been railing about this, and other people have done surveys of this, and it just seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. And I don't know what the solution is. Very frustrated, and I would love to know what you recommend. So please, down in the comments, just let me know what you've done or figured out or anything. I would be interested to know. All right. We'll see you next time.